This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. In theory, we spend a third of our lives asleep, though many of us sleep much less. It is amazing, then, how little we know about sleep and how many sleep disorders go undiagnosed. This fall, the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill and UNC Charlotte are going to offer the first ever bachelor's degree in neurodiagnostics and sleep science. Mary Ellen Wells is the program director of neurodiagnostics and sleep science. She's also an assistant professor in the Department of Allied Health Sciences at UNC Chapel Hill, and she is with us. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Also on the program, Atif Hussain is a professor of medicine in the Department of Neurology at Duke University Medical Center. He is a sleep specialist, and he is with us as well. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Frank. Happy to be here.
So, Marianne, let me ask you how the bachelor's in sleep disorders, sleep science, came about.
Well, about 10 years ago, there's been a national shortage of sleep technologists. And what happened is over those years, the community college has responded to creating new associate degree programs in our state. And currently, North Carolina is the leader in the associate degree programs for sleep technology. And what happened is we identified a new need. Everything brought about this new need for advanced level technologists. So just like other fields are advancing, what we found is that with more sleep technologists, there now is a need for people with advanced skills, such as people to teach in our community college programs, people to take on leadership roles, such as in management, and also people to work in research. And so that's really where this whole idea stemmed from.
When you talk about a sleep technologist, what does a sleep technologist do?
Sleep technologists perform several different types of tests, but basically they perform polysomnography, which is an overnight sleep study. And during that sleep study, the technologist records different parameters, a huge variety of different parameters, such as respiratory parameters, such as EEG, which is brainwave activity, EKG, heart rate, and all of those things help give the technologist an overall picture of the person's health. And they have a lot of responsibility because they're the primary one caring for the patient during the night, and then they also have to do what's called scoring the study, where they have to interpret data and stage the sleep study. They have to be able to instantaneously recognize sleep stages and act accordingly if something happens, if the person goes into respiratory failure or anything like that. They have to be prepared. And then the technologists also have very important roles in patient education, in prevention of sleep disorders, and in helping to recognize these populations.
So you said there's been an increase, a shortage in sleep technologists. Joining us now is Yvette Hewitt. She's interim chair of kinesiology at UNC Charlotte. Hello, Yvette.
Hello.
We've been talking about the shortage of technologists at sleep clinics. Tell us about that. What's caused this, and have we seen an increase in the number of clinics across the state, and why so?
Yes, we have. We've seen an increase in the number of sleep centers that are independent as well as those that are associated with hospitals. I think that the large reason for this is that we have learned a lot more about how sleep affects our daily functioning as well as other parameters of our physiology. We know that, you know, if you don't sleep well, that you are more likely to have other problems, immune function problems, hormone problems, all kinds of different issues. So we've had an increase in this understanding, and if you understand those sorts of things, the medical community wants to be able to know what to do and be able to diagnose you and then help you with those problems.
Well, Atif Hussain, let's take a step back and look at the body biologically, the biological need for sleep. Why do we sleep?
That's a great question, Frank. Unfortunately, after having studied this for decades and probably centuries, we do not know the answer to that. The simplistic answer is that our body needs rest, and that's a period of rejuvenation. We know that we go through different stages of sleep. We know that the brain acts differently in different stages. We don't know why we need different stages, but we do know that when we don't get all the stages, we don't work as well. So there's lots of research being done. There's lots of theories out there. There are theories that talk about metabolic rejuvenation. There are theories that talk about memory consolidation and such. bottom line is we don't know exactly why we sleep, and that's what's so fascinating about sleep.
Because, I mean, obviously, if we say rest, which is the obvious answer, anybody who's laying awake in their bed for 4 or 5 hours and then had to get up knows that they didn't sleep and they are not rested, even though they didn't really move for several hours. So something else has to happen in sleep.
Absolutely. It's not simply an act of lying in bed with eyes closed but brain awake. This is clearly a state where the brain is going to sleep and other physiological things happen. There are neurochemicals released from the brain and other parts of the body that are associated with sleep that help one rest and feel rejuvenated when we get up. And when things go awry is when we really realize the value of sleep. For anyone who's had insomnia for any length of time appreciates the value of sleep. Anyone who has excessive daytime sleepiness appreciates the value of good sleep. So all of us recognize that sleep is critically important and that we need it. Unfortunately, none of us can really tell you exactly why that is the case and what happens when we sleep.
So, Mary Ellen, you've started this new program, a joint program between UNC Charlotte and Chapel Hill, a bachelor's degree in essentially sleep science. Who applies for this? Who's interested in this bachelor's degree?
Well, when we put together the plan for it, we anticipated that the people that would be interested are people that are wanting to move into management roles, people who want to move into education. And we ran a pilot last year. And sure enough, that's exactly who wanted to join the program. And we just had over 50 people apply this time for the program. And the people that we have, they already are in those roles, the roles in management. Several of them are trying to get into education and in research fields. And they're finding that they need that higher degree to put them at that next level to climb that career ladder. They do have to have the bachelor's degree, whether it's their employer telling them that they do need to take their education a step further, or just them wanting to do this for themselves to move up in their career and finish their career at their highest level.
These are already sleep technicians who are already in the business one way or another, and they're trying to move forward. So what do we know now, Yvette, if this is a kind of a cross-disciplinary study, it seems to me, that psychology, psychiatry, medicine, all of them at one time or another probably answered questions about sleep. Now that it's becoming a specialty, what is it that we're learning about sleep that we didn't know, say, 50 or 60 years ago when you'd go to your doctor and say, give me a pill, I can't sleep?
We understand that the problems with people sleeping well are multifaceted. People may have problems with snoring and sleep apnea. We understand now that people have restless leg syndrome. There are people that have stress, and that affects their ability to sleep. So there are a whole variety of things that can cause you to have poor sleep. And we need to be able to diagnose that you aren't sleeping well, figure out what the parameters are that are causing that, and then be able to come up with a treatment plan for you.
What, Mary Ellen, it seems to me that one of the problems a technician might have or a diagnostician is that this is a lot of self-reporting and people telling you what their symptoms are, and in many cases, they're asleep. That's part of the problem. Does that present a particular difficulty for somebody in your profession, the fact that people who are sleep-deprived are telling you what's wrong with them?
Well, it really depends. One of the reasons why we need really well-trained technologists, because sleep apnea is one of the sleep disorders that most people think about when they think about sleep disorders. But in fact, there are 97 recognized sleep disorders. And that's one of the reasons why we're trying to move education forward, because these sleep disorders, they are misdiagnosed. They're under-recognized. The symptoms can be all over the board. And that's why we need sleep technologists that understand all of the different types of things that can happen.
Do you have an idea about how many people just in the state of North Carolina have reported some kind of sleep disorder?
Research has shown that about 1 in 4 people nationwide have some sort of a sleep issue. And in North Carolina, the last numbers that I saw was around 3 million people.
Well, so Atif Hussain, the idea that, as you said, we really still don't know why we sleep. Is this becoming now a specialty? I mean, am I right? 50 years ago, if you had a problem, you were talking to your primary care doctor and saying, I've got a problem. Now there does seem to be more concentrated research on sleep itself. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the last 25 years or so, sleep has really come into its maturity. Or rather, I should say into its infancy, because we still have a long way to go before we get mature. But absolutely. I mean, now sleep is there is subspecialty training for physicians. There is a one-year sleep fellowship that one can do after residency training. In addition to that, there are board examinations that physicians will take to become board certified in sleep medicine. There is a curriculum identified by the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education that we have to adhere to in order to provide graduate medical training. So absolutely, this the professional society is now thousands strong. They're meeting, you know, 20 years ago with several hundred people. Now it's 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people. So indeed, I think this is in large part due to the research that's being done, as well as due to the recognition of the importance of sleep and the importance of sleep disorders. Like Mary Ellen mentioned, the sleep apnea being recognized by patients as well as physicians. Restless leg syndrome, people didn't know what it was 20 years ago. Now people know about it. They seek treatment for it. There are other common disorders. There are circadian rhythm disorders where your sleep schedules are messed up. There's insomnias of various different types. These are all conditions that people used to dismiss as, you know, being stressed out or whatever. And now they're bona fide conditions that we have either medications for or other treatment options for that physicians, psychologists, psychiatrists take care of.
Well, we'll talk about some of those in detail when our program continues. Meanwhile, I want to thank two of our guests, Mary Ellen Wells, a program director of Neurodiagnostics and Sleep Science Bachelor's Degree Program. She's also an assistant professor in the Department of Allied Health Sciences at UNC Chapel Hill. And our thanks to Yvette Hewitt, who is the interim chair of kinesiology at UNC Charlotte. Thanks to both of you. And our program continues in a moment with Atif Hussain, a professor of medicine in the Department of Neurology at Duke University's Medical Center. That happens on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about sleep, what we know about sleep, what we don't know, and what we do when we can't get enough. And I'm talking with Dr. Atif Hussain. He is a professor of medicine in the Department of Neurology at Duke University Medical Center. Joining me now is Jack Ettinger. He is a professor of sleep medicine in the Department of Medicine at National Jewish Health. And Lisa Meltzer is with us. She's an assistant professor of pediatrics at National Jewish Health. She specializes in children's sleep problems. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Jack, what is it that, or why is it that some people have trouble sleeping?
Well, there's a host of reasons, as some of your guests have talked about. You know, I specialize in the area of insomnia, and so I would say a sizable portion of the people that we see with insomnia will have comorbid mental or emotional problems. We have another subset of folks that will have some of the disorders that you've talked about already, an occult sleep apnea or restless leg syndrome. But then we'll also have a number of folks that have primary insomnia that typically has a life of its own and is maintained by beliefs and attitudes patients have about sleep, and also a host of sleep disruptive habits that perpetuate the condition over time.
So you're saying it maintains a life of its own, and some of these habits are what feed this thing. Tell us more about that, some of the ways that we think about sleep that can make things worse.
Well, I mean, so the types of habits that patients get into on the surface are very logical and sensible, and they're sort of what the average person might do when confronted with an ongoing sleep difficulty. So things such as taking a daytime nap after a bad night's sleep, or sleeping in on the weekends, varying your sleep schedule, trying to sleep when sleep comes to you since it's unreliable. These are all sorts of strategies that we commonly see in insomnia that actually will keep the sleep system in a state of dysregulation and make sleep unpredictable and unreliable over time.
So these are some of the problems that people who travel encounter with jet lag as well, advice about not going to sleep or taking a nap when you get there, that kind of thing, so that you can adjust to the time zone. Are they at all correlated, the idea of jet lag and insomnia, or are they two entirely different things?
Well, you know, I actually tell a lot of my patients that, you know, by varying their sleep schedule, you know, day to day, it's a form of jet lag without the scenery. You know, it's they're having the same impact on their sleep as, you know, traveling across time zones might have. And that, of course, from people who have had jet lag, they know that they can't sleep well at night as a function of being out of sync with their body clock. And they also don't function as effectively and alertly in the daytime. So it's the same effect that insomnia patients have in moving their schedule around day to day, chasing sleep, essentially.
Hmm. Right, because then they're never really adjusting. So, Atif Hussain, when we think about that, adjusting your body's clock, we know those are circadian rhythms. It's a kind of a natural clock that keeps us regulated, but we do adjust to it. So why do some people have trouble and others don't, since we know we can make the adjustment to time zones or to different shift work, that kind of thing?
Right. So it is indeed a sleep disorder. It is patients who have difficulty adjusting. Most of us can adjust, and when we can't, it becomes a medical problem, and that's when we seek help. Most commonly, even probably as commonly as jet lag, is something known as delayed sleep phase syndrome. That's something we do initially voluntarily, but then it sort of sticks with us. Mm. And let me give you an example. Kids who go to college typically will not go to bed until 1 or 2 in the morning. They maintain the schedule because they can afford to wake up at 9 or 10 because they schedule their classes that way. When they graduate, unfortunately, their employer will not let them come to work at 10 or 11, and they have a hard time now going to bed at 11 or midnight to wake up in time to go to work.
This is why they take 3 or 4 years to get a job. It's just to make that adjustment, I think. Yeah.
Perhaps. but when they do get a job, they don't do well in it, and then it becomes a circadian rhythm disorder.
Lisa Meltzer, what kind of problems do children have falling asleep? Are they the same problems for the same reasons that adults experience?
It varies by age. In infants and toddlers, you often see difficulties falling asleep as a developmental skill. They're unable to fall asleep without parent assistance, like being rocked or nursed. In toddlers, bedtime difficulties falling asleep is often just protests and stalling. Every parent of a young child gets that request, one more book, one more trip to the potty, just because children start to develop the understanding that the parents don't go to bed at the same time they do, and there's a lot of fun still to be had during the day. School-age children, we see a lot of difficulties with falling asleep due to anxiety, and this has increased over recent years, and this is anxiety and stress related to peers, related to school, activities, but children, the same as adults, become very thoughtful at bedtime, and those thoughts can interfere with falling asleep. And then in teenagers, we see a combination of the two things you just talked about, which is the insomnia, as well as the circadian rhythm phase delay. So when adolescents go through puberty, the natural phase of when their circadian rhythm starts moves later by about 2 hours. So it's not just that teenagers are being obstinate and don't want to go to bed at 10 o'clock. They physiologically can't fall asleep at 10 o'clock. They can't fall asleep until midnight or 1 a.m. And that then clashes very strongly with early school start times.
And there really are developmental changes that take place as we grow and develop and mature.
Absolutely.
So how do you know if your child is having trouble sleeping or if it's just some kind of, again, some reason just to stay up?
You can tell your child is not getting enough sleep by how difficult it is to wake them in the morning. So children should be able to go to bed and fall asleep within about 15 or 20 minutes, 30 minutes at the most. And then once they're asleep, they should sleep pretty well through the night. In the morning when they wake, either to an alarm clock or a parent saying it's time to get up, they should be able to get up and get moving within about 10 or 15 minutes. You should also not see a big time change in terms of what time they wake up. So children who wake up at 7 on the weekdays should not be waking up and getting 5 extra hours of sleep on the weekend. That's a sign that they're not getting enough sleep during the week.
Jack Ettinger, when we talked about some of the habits that we develop when we're having trouble sleeping, I guess one of them is if we don't get a good night's sleep, we're pretty sleepy during the day, and we'll probably kind of over-caffeinate ourselves to keep going, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that, that in the extreme form, can actually backfire. It actually can add to daytime sleepiness, because what happens is caffeine has a relatively long half-life, meaning it takes the body quite a while to metabolize it and burn it off. And it can hang around 3 to 7 hours once consumed. So people that consume caffeine throughout the day may have it hanging around during their sleep period, and then they have a more fragmented and disruptive and non-restorative night's sleep, which then leaves them tired again in the daytime and back in a vicious cycle.
Atif Hussain, do we know about the quality of sleep? There are people who wake up frequently but go right back to sleep, others who sleep through the night. Does it make a difference in terms of your body's need for rest?
Absolutely. People who wake up frequently at night can often the arousals or the awakenings at night could be a manifestation of a sleep disorder. That certainly, encourages one to look further to see why someone is waking up frequently at night. Now, I should add that normal physiology dictates that we wake up frequently during the night, but we very quickly go back to sleep, often don't even realize that we were up. And then when we wake up in the morning, we've only recalled one or possibly two times that we woke up. But if you're waking up frequently and remember all of those awakenings, then there may be something else going on. There may be some type of a sleep disorder or as Jack Ettinger mentioned, caffeine late at night or other things late at night that one does that then result in recurrent awakenings. Another common thing is alcohol that oftentimes people will have late in the evening that can result in similar problems. Paradoxically, that caffeine causes.
And we've been talking a lot about insomnia, but your work is in narcolepsy right now. What is narcolepsy?
Narcolepsy is a very interesting disorder that we previously thought was due to excessive daytime sleepiness. Now we're thinking more that it is a disorder of disrupted nighttime sleep as well as excessive daytime sleepiness. In the last 15 or 20 years, there's been some very elegant research that has shown that there are certain parts of the brain which lose neurons or brain cells. And because they lose these brain cells, there's loss of certain chemicals, and that is probably why narcolepsy happens. There's lots of pieces of the puzzle that still remain unclear. We don't know why some people get it and why others don't. We know why some people have a more severe form and others don't. And we don't know why some people respond well to medications and others don't. So lots of unanswered questions, but there are a lot of effective treatments available for narcolepsy.
Are they mostly medical?
Yes, mostly medical, but there certainly are behavioral treatments available as well. Having a good sleep schedule, having good sleep hygiene, meaning going to bed and waking up at the right time. There are even diets that make one sleep more and or conversely, diets that result in more daytime alertness.
Jack Ettinger, when we were talking now again about insomnia and some of the other disorders that you treat, how many of them are treated effectively medically and how much of it is behavioral?
Well, I mean, a large part of what I do is behavioral treatment. The nice thing about the behavioral intervention for insomnia is that the data show that it has good durability over time. That is, you're essentially teaching folks sleep skills, how to sleep properly again. And once taught, they can continue that on their own indefinitely over time. So if you look at the data in the literature, there are loads of studies that show patients maintain gains during acute treatment, anywhere from 6 months to 2 years out after treatment is done. So, it's fairly effective over time. There are hypnotics that are available for insomnia as well, and those during the course of taking them are generally effective, particularly the newer class of hypnotics that are on the market. However, there are no data in the literature to show that people can be treated with those for a fixed period of time, stop them, and then go back 6 months later, check them, and they're still fine. So that's one of the disadvantages, I guess, of that treatment.
How much of it is related to diet, apart from alcohol and caffeine?
Well, and in my experience, not a whole lot. Unless people have medical issues such as esophageal reflux or something where they're eating late at night and having sleep disruption from that. But it's not, the biggest part of the pie, certainly.
Lisa Meltzer, when you work at it, when you come at it from the behavioral side, are you working mostly with the young people themselves or with their parents or both?
Again, it changes by the age. So when you're talking infants and toddlers, we're working with parents and we're using behavioral interventions to help children learn to fall asleep and return to sleep independently. Around school age and adolescence, certainly we're working with the children as well because so much of what happens with the difficulties of falling asleep is within the child takes control, but the family is so essential for helping children establish good sleep habits, good sleep routines, consistent sleep schedules, that it's very important to approach it with the whole family involved.
Any indication that if a child has a sleep disorder early on, it's going to stay with them for a long time through adulthood, or is it just a stage? Do they grow out of it?
Most children will not just grow out of sleep problems. Some will, but many will not. And there's research showing that in young children, the difficulties with falling asleep at night, wakings, does not go away on its own. And in fact, after 2 or 3 years, not only does the child still have a sleep problem, but the effects of it are wide-ranging, including higher rates of maternal depression. And there's some literature suggesting in adults who look back, they do suggest that, yes, they did have insomnia starting in adolescence or even earlier. So there is some suggestion that these sleep disorders do continue on.
And I guess when we're talking, you've put your finger on it, we can amplify this a little bit more. The problems that you have as a young person can then expand well beyond just sleep and feeling a little bit groggy during the day. You can start having trouble in school. You can fall behind in school. This can have an enormous impact on your life, I would guess.
Absolutely. Children who don't get enough sleep or who have disrupted sleep, it's been shown they have more difficulties with learning, with processing, with remembering. Their behavior is different. We see a lot more hyperactivity, impulsivity. You see a lot more troubles with regulating emotions. So all those meltdowns that children have or moodiness that adolescents have. And, you know, that's just sort of at a basic level. For some children, it could get even worse than that.
Atif Hussain, do we know how much of this is genetic? Is there any genetic link to sleep disorders in some people?
Absolutely. There are certain disorders that are very highly genetically linked. There are certain rare types of insomnia, one in particular known as fatal familial insomnia that's only seen in certain racial groups, very disabling condition. It's a neurologically based condition. Even for the more common types of insomnia, we certainly see that certain disorders run in families. Narcolepsy is one that tends to run in families. Restless leg syndrome has a very strong genetic link. Certain types of sleep apnea even are more likely to be seen in certain families. Sleep apnea can occur due to some anatomical abnormalities, facial abnormalities. So, for example, kids will often look like their parents. If the parents have certain anatomical features that predispose them to sleep apnea, the kids might as well. So there's lots of sleep disorders that do, in fact, run in families.
You talked about restless leg syndrome a couple of times. What is that?
Restless leg syndrome is another condition that people have really started recognizing a lot in the last 10 years or so. This is a very, very disabling condition in which the primary problem is the need to move one's extremities, most often legs. This need to move happens because of an abnormal sensation in the legs. The movement actually improves the sensation, provides a little bit of relief. The problem is that this sensation and this movement happens typically when the individual is lying down and resting, and typically at night. So during the day when you're up and about and so on and so forth, you typically do not have these symptoms. But when you lie down and you're getting ready to sleep, the me time, the time that you're going to relax and sort of chill out, if you will, that's when you can't. Your legs want to move. You want to get up. You want to move around, and you can't seem to relax.
Is this a disorder that has always been with us, do we think? Or is
Indeed. Yeah. This has been described in the 1800s, yeah. and it's only become more recognized recently because there are now very effective treatment options for it.
Jack Ettinger, when we think of insomnia, we think certainly of stress, and we think part of what goes on in sleep is that the brain is trying to process what went on during the day. We don't have a lot of evidence for that, but there's one suggestion I think is one of the possibilities. How much does stress have to do with it, and how much do you counsel people to sort of let go of their thoughts? Is that part of the treatment, part of your advice?
Well, it's a common finding in the patients I see. I mean, they take their thoughts, worries, planning, problem solving to bed, and they can't shut their mind off. So that sort of stress factor is very common, and I spend a lot of time in treatment just focusing on that. And there are specific strategies that we use to interrupt that process and to help them stop that so they can sleep. Certainly, when that occurs during sleep, it causes excessive arousal. And that overrides any normal efforts to sleep, and contributes to the insomnia.
So do you think things are getting worse? I mean, is there something about this modern life that makes that is working against sleep? Certainly, we no longer rise and fall, rise and sleep with the sun anymore. That has to have an effect. Mm-hmm. But just the stresses of modern life, is that making things worse, or just are we more aware of sleep disorders?
No, I mean, I think it certainly is a contributing factor, and I think the prevalence of insomnia has grown some over the decades as a function of that. I mean, currently in our times now, the financial situation probably doesn't help matters either. So, there's a lot of factors that will contribute to people worrying and take that to bed and then have trouble sleeping.
What do you think, Atif Hussain? Modern times, the enemy of sleep?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I've seen people come in complaining about needing to sleep too much during the day. So, unlike Dr. Edinger, I see the opposite end of the spectrum, people who are sleeping too much. And when you talk to them, their schedule goes something like this. I have a standard 8-to-5 job. I have about an hour and a half commute to work, so I end up getting up at 5 in the morning to get dressed by 6, to get to work by 7:30, to get ready for work at 8. I work till 5. Because I'm having difficulty paying my bills after my day job, I then go and work somewhere else until 11, and then I have an hour and a half drive back home. And I get I get home by 12:30, 1 o'clock. I get into bed at 2, to wake up at 6 to start it all over again. And they're concerned that they're sleepy during the day, and they are looking for treatment options. Well, the treatment option is better sleep.
Dr. Atif Hussain, thank you very much. Jack Ettinger, Dr. Atif Hussain is a professor of medicine in the Department of Neurology at Duke's Medical Center. Jack Ettinger, a professor of sleep medicine in the Department of Medicine at National Jewish Health. And Lisa Meltzer is an assistant professor of pediatrics at National Jewish Health. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, what insomnia does to a writer. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Blake Butler has literally stayed awake nights researching his latest book. He's best known for his novels Scorch Atlas and There Is No Year, but when his publisher asked him if he was interested in writing nonfiction, he jumped at the chance. Last year, he published Nothing, A Portrait of Insomnia. In it, he explores his lifelong difficulty sleeping. Blake Butler is on the program right now. Welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Thanks. Nice to be here.
So how did your insomnia start?
I think it's a thing I've always had. My earliest, not my earliest memory, but even when I was a infant, my mom would tell me about having sleep terrors when I wouldn't want to go to bed, and when I did, she would, come to the crib to check up on me, and I wouldn't recognize her and be screaming, and be more afraid of her than anything. So over time, I think I developed a fear of sleep from over imagination or night terrors and different kinds of dreams. And so the longer I suffered that, I think my main problem now is, like you guys were just talking about before the break, was the inability to stop thinking.
Hmm. Well, tell us about those night terrors. Do you remember those, the images that you have, the nightmares that you see?
I have the one thing that I don't remember as an infant, but my earliest memory of being afraid of sleep was I had this dream. And it was basically over a year period or more where I would go to sleep, but once I was asleep, I would have a dream that I was laying in my bed and not able to move, which is, I guess, is more of a parasomnia than a night terror. But I would see a boulder in my ceiling that over the course of the evening, and kind of in real time, the boulder would like slowly roll towards me until it was like right above my face. And then as it would, I guess, hit the point where it would crush you, I would then wake up and it would be morning. So basically it was like being tortured for 8 hours every night instead of going to sleep. Even though I was technically getting rest, I was mentally being tortured.
Sure. And that's and so I'm assuming when you woke up, you didn't feel rested at all and were pretty tired.
Yeah, no. And I can remember trying to do anything that I could to stay awake. So it was a thing I learned to avoid.
So what did your parents do about that?
I went to a therapist as a young child, but I remember I didn't like that. And my mom would read to me in bed and stay up with me. I remember making tapes of myself reading books out loud, and I could lay in bed and then listen to that. And that would kind of teach your brain to stop thinking and you know, listen to the books. But then I would memorize the books, so it's kind of like listening to music, you know, you automatically start, at least for me, like if I can't go to bed listening to music that I know because I want to, I already hear it coming.
So. Right, you sing along with it.
Or, right.
Plus you correct yourself, no doubt.
Exactly.
So what's your experience now with insomnia?
Now it comes and goes. I think writing the book actually really helped me somehow because I did a lot of research and I actually, you know, self-diagnosed some things, and a lot of it I really think is stress. Like you said, the stress and the anxiety of knowing when you go to bed you're not going to just nod off like everyone else, that can be the biggest facilitator of the feeling. So working some of those feelings out also really gave me an outlet, and kind of getting the book out was an accomplishment of sorts. So I think that relieved some of the anxiety, and I sleep a little better now, but particularly when I'm in it's those stress situations, you know, like one stressor can really turn your brain back on.
Well, it's interesting to think about it because there can be an initial stress, you know, I've got to have that draft in by Thursday and I really can't think of a thing, and you're up all night. But if that keeps up, then the stress is I can't get to sleep and I really worry about going to sleep. So even if you've, you know, solved the first problem, now sleep is your enemy.
Oh, yeah.
So what about this? Because I want to put this question to a writer. A lot of it seems to me modern literature in the 20th century, you know, tries to use the language and the vernacular of dream, the irrational, right? And if that's right, I mean, is this a way of sort of getting at those stresses? Is that what's happening in the dream world that we're trying to put to sleep or make sense of a scary and stressful day? And if we don't do that, then it carries over into our waking lives.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree with that. I think a lot of the fiction that I really like, the goal is to not make the familiar unfamiliar, but to make the unfamiliar familiar. Mm. So you're kind of, we have all these huge grappling issues that I think have gotten even weirder. As I think when I was doing my research, the two biggest contributors to insomnia over time were, the first was the invention of interior light, you know, because that changed day and night were now the same. You could work all night. And then the second was the internet. So because now there's always activity going on. And I think that the internet has also been hugely influential on writing and styles and yeah, just that I'm never really asleep. You know, I could be doing anything at any hour. So that's definitely becoming a big style change in literature, I think.
What are some of the other things that you found in your research that surprised you about sleep disorder, about insomnia?
Well, I guess one big thing was I learned a lot about how, and you guys were talking about this before, about taking care of children. There's kind of the 70s, I guess, when parenting really became important, and there were all these theorists who were telling you how to take care of your child. That was actually counterproductive, because instead of having one way to do it, you now had seven different theories on how long your child should sleep. And, you know, if they're 5 to 6, they should sleep 9 to 10 hours, and then 7 to 8 should do this. And then this other guy says this thing. So it actually became the more information there was, as opposed to being informative, it actually scattered the idea so widely that no one really knew what to do anymore.
Yeah, we don't know a lot about sleep. We don't know why it works and why it works for us, or even the mechanisms. We can sort of measure. We know there are four levels, but that doesn't tell us what we need to know. So what have you learned about for yourself? You said that it was helpful for you just to do the research. How so?
Well, I guess, like I said, I have the busy brain. I'm always tired when it's time to go to bed, but it's the busy brain. And particularly, I think my generation in particular is in a weird position where the same kind of scattering that happened to bedtime behaviors also happened to, like, careers. So, I mean, like, a lot of people went to college because they know they're supposed to, but then they get out, and it's not like your grandfather. Like, all my grandfather's or a lot of my family worked for, I'm going to go work for GM, you know, and like I'm going to be there for 50 years. I'm going to retire with GM. Now you don't really see that as much. You see, you go get a job, you work for this company for 4 years, maybe they go under, or maybe they let you go. And then now what are you going to do? So I've always worked freelance, and I've worked on the internet. So that kind of scattering is really, like, for an ambitious person, it's hard to grapple with, you know, like you should be doing something that will have you a career over your lifetime, but it's also not so clear anymore. So I think that's what I'm always thinking about, especially as a writer, because that's even a more amorphous thing. Like, how am I going to be successful at writing? Well, you can't go out and do any one thing that will make that true.
But it's interesting to think about this as sort of having been part of the human condition forever, whatever stresses and worries. I mean, even if it was, you know, the group of primates on the other side of the river looking menacing, one way or another, we've come to terms with that. Maybe dreaming has helped us. And now it seems that we're just, for some reason, it's either the quality of the stress or maybe the quantity of it, that we just don't seem to be able to adjust. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think it's... sleeplessness has always occurred, but I do think that there's way more question marks than there ever were. And partially it's because that hole that we're trying to elucidate keeps getting deeper. You know, like, we learn more about sleep, and then they're like, oh, well, there's now all this whole other branch of sleep that we know nothing about. So now we have to go even deeper. So it just kind of keeps digging the hole under you.
You, in your book, you reference Borges' story, The Infinite Library. Tell us what connection that has with insomnia.
Oh, so this Borges story is one where basically it's a theory about, it's kind of a dream theory that he has, where he thinks about a library where all books that could ever be written by mathematical combination of the letters there are in the alphabet already exist. So that includes every book, that includes, you know, any book that is written now, but it also includes gibberish combinations, like, any possible combination of letters is already there. And so, but then somewhere in that range of books is what would be considered the perfect book. So he's kind of like telling you there's this gold coin in the middle of this pile of sand. And I think that for me, that's kind of what the world feels like, in that you're often just parsing what day to day feels like, either gibberish or, like, you know, a lot of people feel meaninglessness about going to the grocery or just any simple thing. But the idea that there is a already existing context for your thoughts, even if it's theoretical,
right,
to me is interesting.
Well, I wonder, and certainly writers like Borges and other modern writers have tackled this problem, this question of, you know, sort of how do we think really? And they noticed that the kind of linear thinking in books and in literature that preceded them wasn't really the way things worked. And so we got this kind of stream of consciousness, associative writing. Are they onto something there? Is there something about, is there a too big a gulf between our kind of sense of rational order that, you know, may or may not really exist, and the way things really are in our heads, kind of all scrambled and associative?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at realism in writing, like, if you pick up a book by, like, John Updike, and they're like, this is realism, to me, that seems even more alien than something like Borges, because, The more concretely you try to make an A to B story out of life, it just seems more and more fake to me. It's like a sitcom, you know? It's
right.
Like, sitcoms aren't how we live, and everyone knows that. But then you pretend, like, the idea that there are characters make it real. Well, I think you can never know a person to the way that we know characters on TV. And it's more honest to approach it as if we know that.
You ever speculate that might be part of the problem, is that there's this big disconnect between the way you're expected to think about things and the way that inner kind of irrational mind is saying, hey, pal, it doesn't work that way, and you're trying to put the two worlds together in one head?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, we've learned that entertainment works that way, but I also don't think it should, you know, and I think that is why people have been... the world of entertainment is kind of changing that way. It's either getting more and more base to me, or it's getting more and more, people are like, I don't even know how to deal with that. But I think if you set down some of those ideas about what a story can be, then you're opening the door.
So do you think that insomnia has influenced your writing?
Oh, certainly. I mean, it's influenced me as a person. So, I mean, I'm up at night, you know, my general waking period is 10 a.m. to like 3 or 4 p.m. I mean a.m. So I'm awake long after most of my friends go to bed, and I've come to, like, really that period of isolation and feeling like everyone else in the world is asleep, like affects me as a person, so it has to affect my writing. And I think that it kind of levels that idea that the surreal world is so different from the real world. Like, I kind of like marry them together and it feels natural.
Yeah. But is there a point at which the quality of your work suffers? You have to sort of redo a lot of stuff because you were just too tired.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a big romantic notion about insomnia. You know, like, I tell people I have trouble sleeping, and they're like, oh, well, that's why you're such a prolific writer, you know, like, because you have all these extra hours. But really, that's so untrue to me. Like, when I'm in a really bad period of having trouble sleeping, like, I wake up and I feel like mush. I feel like just I'm sitting there at a machine, you know. It doesn't give you more time. It gives you worse time.
Yeah.
So
it's just the fact that if you happen to offset or shift those hours, find yourself awake in the wee smalls on a good night's rest, that's a pretty productive night for you. Is that
totally? Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a difference between short-term insomnia where, like, oh, this is one day out of the week where I'm having trouble. That's way different than, like, I haven't slept more than 2 hours in 3 weeks. You know?
Right. So apparently the longest you've ever stayed awake was 129 hours?
Yeah, yeah. I had mono, too.
Mono, you're supposed to sleep when you have mono.
I know. I think that's part of my personality is, like, the more you're supposed to do this thing, the way I go the opposite. So my body was like, oh, well, you're telling me to sleep, so no.
What was that like, 129 hours? I mean, were you drowsy? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I was 18, so I was still living with my parents, and it feels like one long day, you know, like, I can't really differentiate the periods. I remember, like, I started seeing colors, and I remember at one point having a conversation with this head that came out of the wall, and I remember just crying, like, walking around the house crying, and like, I would come into the room where my mom was, and she seemed like she was 100 feet away from me when she was right across the counter. And there's just no explanation. You just stand there, you know? You're like a zombie.
You still having nightmares?
Now?
Yeah.
I think I always have nightmares. I actually kind of love nightmares because I love waking up feeling like I've been through something intense. So, yeah, I have pretty strange and violent dreams pretty often, but I like that.
Your fiction is associative. It's dreamlike. You said you want to sort of make sure that there's that irrational feel, that we're not too contrived in your work, and you accomplish that. Do you ever, I mean, have you ever taken the stuff of the dream sort of whole cloth and put it into your work?
I've tried to do that, but I think that doing that is a lot harder than just coming up with things that naturally flow together, because, like, one of the interesting things about dreams is the logic you're in. You know, like, you can be in a dream and be like, you can see a person in a dream and know a whole world about them that's totally illogical outside of the dream. Like, this person birthed my mother and they're buying me pizza, like, but they were also alive 10,000 years ago, and you just know that by looking at them in the dream. Like, the logic in dreams is often inherent to it, and I think that that's why people say dreams are boring to hear from other people, because you don't get that whole context. But you can develop things like that in fiction, but I think taking them straight out can be kind of difficult.
Yeah, the hard thing is to try to get that logic structure written into the book without the details of the dream, which, as you say, that's not my dream. I don't want to hear about your dream. But that logic is fascinating.
I've always thought that logic was a really underrated thing for storytelling, because, like, people really rely on characters and place and setting, but logic is so much more interesting to me.
And there are many different forms. The dream kind, the most interesting. Blake, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Blake Butler, the author of Nothing, A Portrait of Insomnia. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening to The State of Things, a program produced by Alex Granados and Sean Nguyen. Sarah Edwards is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Al Wadarski sitting in today. Lindsay Foster Thomas, our managing editor. Susan Davis, the senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.